I'm joined on the line by David Sacks, a well-known author and journalist whose work explores Jewish history and identity, both globally and right here at home. He's written extensively about the early pioneers who laid the foundation of Torah learning and Frumkeit in South Africa, those whose quiet devotion built the vibrant religious communities that we see and are so happy to be part of today. So who were these early pioneers? What inspired them? And what can we learn from their stories, particularly in times of spiritual searching and challenge? David Sacks, the former Associate Director of the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, the author of many books and articles on Jewish history, thank you so much for joining me on the home run. If we can start, David, with the word Frumkeit, how would you define it in a South African Jewish context, and how has that definition evolved over time?
I think it's quite new, you know. I think it really started really becoming a common currency during the what was called the Baal Tshuva movement, which started in the South Africa. Well, it really got going in South Africa, so in Johannesburg particularly. It's in the 1970s. So Frumkeit, I suppose the core mitzvahs that somebody would keep to be strictly Shomer Shabbat, and obviously keeping kashrut strictly. But I think Shabbat is really the testing point. Once you start keeping Shabbat strictly, then you would be considered frum.
Who were some of the key figures who brought Torah learning and religious life to South Africa, and what motivated them to do so in, I guess, what was then a remote and unfamiliar place?
Yeah, look, it was very, very hard to get serious religious practice, to get it going in South Africa. And they were faced, the people were facing the tests that we can't imagine, you know. It was so hard to get a job. You would have to go into business for yourself, really. But it was very rare for people to close their businesses on Shabbos. For the first half of the century, it was, you could count them on the fingers of one hand.
What made it so hard, David?
They were new immigrants. I mean, they came out from Eastern Europe. They had to learn not even just one but two new languages. They had to learn Afrikaans as well. They came with very little. I mean, the reason they came to South Africa was because Lithuania was so poor. You know, they came here to really start from scratch. I don't say it wasn't anti-Jewish so much, but I mean, if Saturday was a work day, they didn't recognize religious rights to the extent that they do today. But
and people were focused on making a living. I mean, you had to survive.
That's it. It was very hard. They had to work long hours, just to really start from the very bottom up and work themselves up. And it was a big test for people, and the majority didn't pass that test. That's reality.
Were many of those early Jewish pioneers who came here from Lithuania religious and observant?
You know, I mean, some were, and somehow against the odds, they remained religious. They kept all the basic mitzvahs. They carried on learning. But I think the very fact that they came out here, which in the first place, For the most part, I mean, they knew they were coming to a place that was really, it had no Torah institutions, no schools. It was a big problem, for education. It suggests that they probably weren't that religious to begin with, for the most part. I mean, there were, of course, as I say, exceptions who stuck to it. The same happened in America. There was a big mass migration of Jews and other people from Eastern and Central Europe. It was the end of the 19th century. They came to England, but also to America, and huge numbers. And about 2 million Jews were amongst them. And they lost their Yiddishkeit almost, if not overnight. I mean, they couldn't pass it on to their children. The next generation were really fry, as we say.
What was the difference between America and South Africa? Because, you know, the assimilation in the United States has always been of great concern, but I don't think we ever had the numbers in South Africa that they had there. So how was the community able to retain their
food? I think it was pretty much not much of a muchness. If anything, you know, America was stronger, because even though it was the same assimilationist temptations and impulses were all present, there was a core Torah community. There were institutions much more developed than was the case in South Africa. I mean, South Africa was so rudimentary, and the assimilation in the United States, especially the high intermarriage, which is worse in Europe, by the way, even worse. But it only started to become a problem from the 1960s onwards. Back then, even though Jews still tend to marry other Jews, plus, of course, America has become less religious in general, which means in the old days, somebody who was Christian would want to marry a fellow Christian, and they'd have a problem marrying someone who wasn't Christian. With the decline of religiosity, concerns have fallen away, so there's a greater willingness to marry across the religious divides, and so there's so little religious commitment from either party anyway.
The community, the South African Jewish community, was it always receptive to Orthodox or Torah true values, or was there resistance in the early years?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That's where South Africa does differ from America, from the United States, because even though people weren't keeping the Torah fully, they were still the kind of Orthodox shuls and so on. But there was this underlying respect and I think reverence for the Jewish tradition. It came from that Lithuanian background. You know, they brought that with them. They weren't out and out heretics. They weren't. There was a respect for people who were religious, and That remained. That was never lost. In the United States had become, and of course reform had taken over there. The reform movement started there, I think late 1880s it started, and it really became very powerful very quickly. Mm. It only was in the 1930s that they introduced reform in South Africa. It never took off to anything like the same extent.
Because?
Even though the reform in South Africa, they were frummer, as it were, in the United States, and they had to be. That's another story, by the way. The whole story of how reform started, and how the reform Jews in the early days, they were more religious, more committed, and idealistic than the average lackadaisical, going through the motions. People would go to an Orthodox shul, but really didn't. Weren't committed to it. It's another story which I can talk about. A very interesting thesis.
I've already made a note of that.
Done about it.
Okay, so that's...
You must talk to Erwin Manoim, who's...
We actually have him down. He's overseas at the moment, so that's exactly what I will ask him. But I do have one question about the reform for you. Yeah. Why did it not take off in South Africa like it did in America?
To quite the same extent. I think because of this underlying... dedication. This is a kind of underlying loyalty to the Orthodox roots. I think, although most Jews would, they weren't keeping the mitzvahs. They were only keeping, you know, very very partially. They were, you know, it was a step too far to move away from Orthodoxy altogether and start going to a reform shul. There was resistance to that, on the whole.
David, how?
But there was, of course, quite a strong core of the reform movement was fairly strong in its early days. It's weakened since then. But as I said, well, you're talking to Erwin Noy, you'll talk about it. He wrote a book about it, a very interesting book.
How did the institutions like shuls, yeshivot, and cheders grow alongside broader community life in South Africa? Were there turning points in the development?
Yeah, well, the big turning point came. It took till post World War II. That's really where there were no yeshivot, and there were Jewish day schools, but they were sort of the kind of King David national traditional, very Zionist focused, very cultural Jewish. They did have that religious component as well, but it they weren't religious schools. The first school to start that actually was an Orthodox Jewish school that taught traditional basically taught, started to teach the basics of Torah learning. Well, that was a yeshiva college, which started as a small learning program for after school learning program for a couple of dozen, you know, interested teenagers. It was very modest beginnings, but it took root. You know, from those modest beginnings, it became a seed, which it became a school, and yeshiva college just carried on growing. Of course, it had brilliant leaders. Rabbi Tanzer was a real legend, as we know. Zatzal, he made a huge difference. And Rabbi David Sanders, who's still, thank God, alive and well in the United States, but he was a very dynamic early teacher. As I said, the numbers just grew. Yeshiva College carried on growing until well into this century. It only started to decline in numbers, you know, with the decline of the community in the last few years.
We certainly have. But
from Yeshiva College came, then from there came other schools, some directly from Yeshiva College. You know, the Yeshiva Maharsha schools started as a Yeshiva College initiative originally. It wasn't the intention, but. Then there was the Hirsch Lion schools also indirectly came from because of Rabbi Goldfein. They started Yeshiva Gedola on the Yeshiva campus. Rabbi Goldfein, he took it out. He took it as an independent movement and still carries on today. And from there came the Hirsch Lion school system. Then they got another yeshiva, another Rosh Yeshiva for Yeshiva Gedola. This is Yeshiva College. They brought Rabbi Aaron Pfeiffer in the late 1970s, I'm sorry. And he also went independent and started the Yeshiva Maharsha, which has got its whole school system of itself, as well as being a very, you know, strong community. So a great deal of what we see started with the Yeshiva College, and all started with this little group that meet in Berea and that get like after hours classes in Chumash and Mishnah. They weren't even learning Gemara in those days. But some of those youngsters who went there, they became Rabbonim. They came back to South Africa, you know. Rabbi Sushard, if you know him, he was one of the very early students there, and he played a very big role in the history of the community, in the Torah community, as we know.
David, I'll wrap it up there, but certainly a fascinating history that we all share here, and particularly when we talk about the pioneers of the growth of Torah and Frumkeit in South Africa.
Yes,
That's David Sacks, the former Associate Director of the Jewish Board of Deputies of South Africa, author of many books and articles on Jewish history. Thank you so much for joining us.